Hi, Barb. Let's see. Still got about a minute, 30 seconds.
Does somebody have a bird?
I'm thinking I hear a bird chirping.
Yeah, I hear a bird chirping. Whose bird is it?
I've got the
Am
door
I?
open. Back, I've got the back door open.
Oh, okay.
They've been quite vocal all week long.
Oh, good.
Okay.
That's beautiful. I love the birds.
Okay, let's take a minute to or a moment or so, it doesn't matter what the time limit is, just tune in, relax, open. And notice that we enter into this time and space as a divine consciousness, as a human consciousness, an ego and a personality. We enter into this space with our histories, with our preconceived notions, none of which do we need to deny or throw away. At the same time, it's interesting, we have to use that word time. At the same time, we are releasing some of our identification with energies or vibrations that are not in alignment with our divine consciousness. You don't have to do anything about that. You just need to be aware that those things are being erased or lifted. It's like Jesus said, come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest. You don't have to carry that shit anymore. Before we get started on tonight's material, I wanted to share something with you. By the way, this will probably be repeated in some of my other classes. But I had a revelation last night. And this is probably just going to make sense or make more sense to the people who are in recovery. But I think we're all in recovery in some way, so it works for everybody. And what I'm going to say is probably going to sound terribly simplistic, terribly obvious even. But it somehow or another, the energy behind this thought touched my heart. In a way that was different in my understanding. And that was, I was sitting in an AA meeting last night, and they got into reading a section of the big book, which is called How It Works, which is primarily about the 12 steps. And I realized at that moment that the 12 steps are a pathway to higher consciousness, to divine wisdom. Now, I might have known that on some level of my being for a long time, but the simplicity and the eloquence of that this is a pathway to higher consciousness, exactly what we're talking about. And there it is, right. It's been right in front of me for over 40 years. And some, you can look at it literally as being a list of things that help keep people sober. I recognize that. But what my sense was, it's much more than that as well. It's a pathway, at least from my way of understanding, it's a pathway to higher consciousness, to divine consciousness, to Christ consciousness, whatever words you want to put in there. And it was so subtle and so powerful at the same time. It just kind of knocked my socks off. I said, well, here it is. You know, you can pick up this book, pick up another book, pick up Course in Miracles. You're going to find the same thing in some ways. But here was a practice that was put together in the 1940s. Here was a practice that was put together primarily for the purpose of helping people get sober. And what I realized at that particular moment, that there's also a much deeper meaning to that whole process. The reason why, and I've studied this years ago, but the reason why I discovered that the 12 steps work as a spiritual pathway is because they contain all the necessary elements that any other spiritual path contains, whether it's Buddhism, mystic Christianity, Zen, Taoism, Sufism, whatever it might happen to be, it's all right there. It's stated a little bit differently, but it's right there in front of me. So I was very grateful for that, as simple as it was. I'm going to begin on page 109. Second paragraph, around the middle of the page. The realization, underline the word realization, of what you are, the manifest divine that has come as you, in some ways realizes itself and overrides some of what the soul would choose to learn through, because you learn in different ways as the realized self, who is knowing itself as the Christ of truth that has come in form for the benefit of all. While the soul may choose to learn through fear, or through its lower nature, because everything here is to be learned through, no matter what it looks like. Not escape from or run from, but learn through. As the divine self sees itself and knows itself beyond fear, it releases the need to confirm fear, because fear is in low vibration. I don't deny it. I don't pretend it's not there. I could see peace instead of this. I could see this differently. And the divine self as you, that has come as you, that operates in a higher frequency and must claim all things in a conference of that high octave in co-resonance, to justify fear in any way, shape, or form, is to claim fear in its purview. And the purview of fear, as we have taught, is to claim more fear to realize itself again and again and again through itself as fearful. And we could substitute any other form of negativity, whether it's anger, fear, resentment, separation, outrage, like my bumper sticker, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. You know, yeah, I want that. That's what I needed. I needed more outrage. And then I had to find out what my outrage is getting me. So we can apply this particular formula to claim more fear, to claim more separateness, to claim more anger, to claim more outrage, to realize itself again and again and again through itself becomes just more of the same. And so, again, to go back to 12-step literature, which every once in a while it kind of fits in lots of different places. It says very simply that even justified resentment is a luxury that we could ill afford. In other words, I have every right to be angry at so-and-so because of what they did or what they said or whatever. Even justified resentment or justified anger is a luxury we can ill afford. Because what it does is it starts paving the road for other rationalization. Well, if I can hold on to that one, if I can say, well, this is a wonderful circle that everybody belongs in here except you. And once I start on that particular road, I continue on that particular road.
Mm-hmm.
Once I get sucked into separateness, I create more separateness. I'm sure that doesn't happen to you, but it happens to me.
Jerry.
Yeah.
I just read the other day something that really helps me about judging people and with resentments. And it said that God is in all things, the trees and people. Mm-hmm. So if you damn them, you're damning God.
Yeah.
And that helps me a lot to remember that, you know, watch, God is in all things. Watch my resentments, watch my anger, watch my fear, watch my judgment. It's God in all things. Just like us.
Just like us. In the beginning of John's gospel, talks about everything was made through the word of God. Mm-hmm. And nothing was made without it. I mean, there is that truth just kind of standing out like in a neon light right there, right in the beginning. And how easily I get tripped up on that. I forget. Oh, you're part of this too. Oh, pushing you out of the circle. Well, I push you out of the circle, I push myself out as well. I don't need to do that.
I just read the other day too, Jerry, that Jesus was in this world, but he was not of this world. And what was different about him was he had no fear of this body, of what would happen. He had no fear.
He was not attached.
No.
Now, he had to learn that. I don't think he was born that way and just was kind of looking up out of the crib and say, well, you know, I got to wait 30 years before I can start practicing all this. I think he obviously studied and learned all of that, but came to the conclusion, I and the Father are one. And since we are one, there's nothing that can be left out of that picture. Absolutely nothing. And because that's true, the way the Course puts it is to recognize that nothing of importance can be taken away from me. When I realize that, there's nothing to be afraid of. Nothing can take away my oneness. Nothing can get in the way of unconditional love. As Paul said, even if I give up my body to be burned, doesn't matter. Of course, I'm not quite there yet, okay. But I understand what he's saying, right? When we get to a point where we recognize everyone and everything is a manifestation of the divine, then there's absolutely nothing to be afraid of. To experience fear. Where did I lose that thing? What will happen if I don't find it? Is a response to a situation. Pretty human response. To act in fear would be to decide that the terrible thing that you've imagined could happen if you lost the item will be the death of you. And to confirm that through the actions you take is to claim the act of fear in perpetuity. In other words, to keep on generating more fear. To realize the divine is present in all things is not to confirm that there are things happening that you could not agree to or confirm as a personality self as a positive thing. We're not talking about the personality. We're not talking about how my ego looks at the world or how my ego perceives myself. We don't ask you to abnegate the power that you've been gifted with to discern, to know the difference between what works and what doesn't. But to understand that, as nothing is out of God, the very presence of the one who knows who he is, what she is, how he serves, reclaims what is seen and renown in a higher octave to lift to a new sight, a new awareness of reclamation. The reclamation of the divine, which will be this chapter, if we are allowed to complete it, has ramifications on what is seen and known. It is not ideology. It is not presupposition. Well, that thing is holy because everything is holy, so just let it be. In some ways, that is denial. You see someone suffering. Well, God is there anyway, so be it. It is taken care of. It is to wash your hands from the responsibility of what you are being aligned to as the witness to suffering. My response to another's suffering. I can certainly choose compassion. I might not choose to stop alongside the road and help somebody fix a flat tire because I suck at doing that. They'd probably get a lot more out of me saying a prayer for them than me trying to fix their tire. And that could be a rationalization on my part, but that's where I'm at the moment. I witness someone who is suffering. Compassion comes from my recognition of my own suffering as well, because I know what that's like. It's not just a feeling or it's not just an emotion. It's a realization. I don't deny that. I don't deny my role in creating some of the suffering that might be going on with some of the human beings. My question is, you know, what can I do to alleviate that? And again, it might be prayer. Might be holding them in the light. Might be donating to a certain charity that seems to work for me. I mean, there's lots of ways of being able to do that. But we are being asked in some ways to make our response or to allow our response to be personal. I might have shared this story with you a while ago, but a couple of years ago, our granddaughter was really sick and she was in the hospital in a coma. And Margot and I were shuttling back and forth between Chicago and Louisville. And what I would do would be I would come up to Chicago on usually Sunday afternoon, right after church, and get up there, and I would stay up there till Friday or Saturday, helping Finn, my grandson, with his homework, making his lunch, take it to school, doing all the Mr. Mom kind of stuff. And I remember one time I was getting ready to get on the highway, and I passed by this shopping center in Chicago, downtown Chicago, and there was a lady sitting there who I recognized was sitting there a lot, you know, had one of her little tin cup out. And I remember seeing another woman walk by and drop some money in the cup. She walked about 5 or 10 feet away, and then she turned around. And I was still waiting at the traffic light here. And I saw her walk up to this woman and grab a hold of her hands. And I could not hear the dialogue that was going on. But the energy that I got from that was something to the effect of, I want to know who you are. You're not just a dollar that I put in a cup. I want to know your name. Maybe you can tell me how you got in this particular place, but I want to see you as a fellow human being. I want to know you beyond whatever it is you're stuck in. And it was such a glorious moment for me to feel that. Here was another human being opening themselves, not just dropping a dollar in a cup and moving along.
Mm-hmm.
But truly opening them up in compassion to another human being and saying, that's where the energy is. That's where the energy is. It is not ideology. It is not presupposition. Well, that thing is holy because everything is holy, so just let it be. In some ways, that is denial. You see someone suffering. Well, God is there anyway, so be it. It's taken care of. Where's the love? Where's the compassion? Where's the humanness? It's like somebody slips on the ice and go, oh, bad karma. That's true. You know, but where's the humanness? Where's the compassion? Where's the connection? Well, God is there anyway, so be it, it's taken care of, is to wash your hands from the responsibility of what you are being aligned to as the witness of suffering. Your humanity is becoming engaged. Allow it to become engaged. It hurts sometimes. Allow it to hurt. In the sight of suffering, the action of the divine is to transform pain through the realization of God that can and must be known in the high octave that you perceive it from. Let me say that again. In the sight of suffering, the action of the divine, as you, is to transform pain through the realization of God that can and must be known in the high octave that you perceive it from. Understand, friends, it is the divine that witnesses and acts upon it, not the small self who would run to fix it as she assumes it should be fixed, and not as the aspect of the self that would deny responsibility for what she witnesses, but the self that knows who she is. And because she knows who she is, she realizes herself in participation to the thing seen. Understand what this means. If nothing is outside of God, and the divine as you is present, and you are witnessing suffering, you are claiming the action of God, the presence of God in realization through what you are perceiving. To realize is to know. And when something is known in the higher octave, it is reclaimed and renown and lifted to the essence of the source that permeates all matter. Everything is touched. Ram Dass used to tell this story of standing on a little mountaintop in India, looking down at this poor village. People were hungry, people were sick. And his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, said, Ram Dass, can't you see it's all perfect? And he said, I was offended by that because it wasn't perfect at all. These people are hurt. These people are starving. These people need help. And he said that out loud. He said, that offends me. These people need something. Sure, it's not easy for you to say it's all perfect. And his guru looked at him and smiled and said, yes, you're right, Ram Dass. Get down and help them. Now, I'm still getting the gist of that story. Because part of it is that we're living in a world of a dual reality. It's absolutely perfect the way it is. And at the same time, we're being asked to help. We're being asked to heal. We're being asked to aid. We're being asked a part of it. In other words, part of the perfection is drawing my compassion out of me and pushing me to become more actively involved in the world. Isn't that interesting? Somebody else is hurt or somebody else is suffering is absolutely perfect because part of what it's doing, I don't know what it's teaching them, but it's teaching them whatever it needs to teach. But it's also drawing me out in compassion to go beyond my personality, ego, consciousness, to feel for, to help in some ways another human being. So it's doing a whole bunch of different things, not just one. It's not just one person suffering. And whatever we do to alleviate the suffering of another affects everyone and everything. No matter how simple that might be. You know, there are times I still perceive myself. I wouldn't identify with this completely. I still perceive myself as someone who is prone to depression or depressive moods. However, I can't tell you the number of times when I have been lifted out of a depression that I've been struggling with, that I have been lifted out of it through no effort on my own. You know, because one minute I'm depressed, the next minute I'm not. And I often wonder, you know, who it is. It might be some monk that's 5,000 miles away who is praying for another human being who is suffering, that somehow or another the energy of that prayer touches me, touches my heart, and touches my soul in a way that little monk 5,000 miles away has no idea, nor does he care because he's not attached to it. I know my prayer is doing something. I have no idea what it is, and I don't care. It doesn't matter. But may this meditation of mine, may this silence of mine, may this prayer of mine touch another human being with love and compassion, and it will happen. How many times has that happened without me even knowing it? You often wonder why somebody that you haven't thought of in 30 years comes into your mind. My impression of that is that it's their soul asking you to pray for them at that moment. Because your prayer for them is absolutely unique. It is coming from your human and divine experience of being here on planet Earth, and no one and nothing can offer a prayer with that same kind of energy as you can at that particular moment. So instead of dismissing that and just saying, oh, that's so-and-so, I wonder what they're doing, and then, you know, what's for lunch? A couple minutes, 30 seconds. I hold you in the light. I hold you in the truth of who you are. I bless you. Thank you.
This is really a beautiful lesson tonight, Jerry. It's hitting home with me. And I'm guilty of one of those people who says, can look at someone who's sick or suffering and feel like, I can't fix it. I can't change it. This is God's will. God will take care of it. But I've lost my empathy and compassion, just like you said, with people. Instead of thinking like that, being able to go up to them, and my prayer could be verbal.
Sure.
And to feed them verbally and say, yeah, tell me about yourself. Just show them love. Just to show them love. And I'm very guilty of this in saying, God's in control, God's in charge. And if I can't fix things. And I get in trouble because I don't know how to show empathy and compassion versus trying to fix things. I'm an alcoholic and I gotta fix things. I'm a fixed managing control person. But I can do it, just like you said, through prayer, and it can be a verbal prayer. It goes right up to that sick person and says, God loves you.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as that.
Thank you.
I like that. Thank you.
There's a whole other side to this as well. I haven't heard too many people talk this way recently. But when we first got into this study, let's call it, of creating your own reality, you know, and talking about that and showing people how they do that through their thought, their thinking process. When we first started studying that or working with that, one of the forms that it took was, if somebody is sick or somebody is ill or dying of cancer, you know, their liver's getting eaten up, or, well, they're doing it to themselves.
Mm.
And, you know, I used to just have to shake that off because there was something, I couldn't explain it at the time, but there was something very wrong with that teaching. Or with that understanding of that teaching. Yes, we do contribute to our own well-being and to our own ill-being. I don't deny that reality. Okay. But to blame somebody for having an illness or being imperfect is so foreign to what true spirituality is all about, is just sort of unbelievable to me now. And so, I mean, let's suppose, you know, I am sick or I am dying. And yes, I had something to do with creating that I'm creating my ticket out of here. Let's put it that way. I had some input in creating my ticket out of here. At the same time, the rationalization or the creation of that has so many ramifications that I couldn't possibly begin to follow all of those threads. I don't know what they all are. And so to overly simplify and say, well, you created that. That's why you're sick. Hmm. The reason why your liver is failing is because you're holding on to so much anger. That's why you're so sick. To me, anyway, that smacks of such really spiritual abuse. Because I don't know why. Let's stop concentrating on even why or wherefore you might be sick. And let's focus on your wellness and my wellness and how you can experience yourself on a higher level of consciousness. I had a friend of mine in Al-Anon call me a couple of years ago and said that her husband, who I only met once, I think, her husband had been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer and was not quite ready for hospice, but was getting there at that stage. And she said, he knows you a little bit because he's heard some of your talks. Would you be willing to work with him for a while? And I said, of course I would. So I would go over and to his house every week, and we would sit and talk for a while, and I would do some meditative imagery and things like that with him. And it took me a while to realize this, because we had some laughs and we had some tears as well. It took me a while to realize that what he was asking me to do, and what I was doing without him asking, was I was helping him to die. I was helping him to let go of his body. And I was dumbstruck at the power and the beauty of that realization, that another human being would be so willing, and that I would not take that on as being a burden or anything else, but just take it on actually somewhat joyfully. And so it gave me a whole different vista, a whole different viewpoint of sin, of disease, of sickness, of working with other people, and of release, of letting go, and seeing who he is, or who he was, beyond his physical body. Because that was so much of our work, to see him beyond his physical body. Down at the bottom of page 110. Paul is interrupting. Oh, thank you, Paul. Are we fixing suffering then? You must have read Diane's message. Are we fixing suffering? That is not what we are saying at all. Notice the question, are we fixing? It's a small self question. It's a small self coming from lower consciousness, lower vibration. Not bad, but extremely limited in its scope. Right? In other words, are we fixing suffering then? That is not what we are saying at all. If you think of fixing, you think of mending. To reclaim something is to know it anew. To fix it is to put the bandage on it and send it back on its way. Put on a band-aid, pat him on the shoulder, saying, take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. Okay. There are wounds that will not be fixed with a bandage. Just that one sentence, there are wounds that will not be fixed by a bandage, reminds me of a one of my favorite quotes from a Jungian psychologist. Her name is Marion Woodman. Woodman, thank you. God comes through the wound. God comes through the wound. To the person who is wounded, as well as to all those who are around him and her, God comes through the wound. There are wounds that will not be fixed with a bandage. There are hells that cannot be released through pretending that hell does not exist. That's a great one. What a great one-liner. There are hells that cannot be released through pretending that hell does not exist. I could go on that one for a long time, but I'm not going to. Everybody's probably got their own story around that one. I encourage you to remember what that was and respect that. That every one of us has experienced the hell. And the only way through it, the only way out is through. Not over and around. The only way out is through. What a hell is a belief in the absence of light or the potential for healing, for realization, for re-knowing. What hell is the decision that God cannot penetrate or realize itself in what already is, which would be an impossibility. Not even God can change this. Flip side of that, the Roman centurion saying to Jesus, only say the word and my servant shall be healed. You don't have to come to my house. Don't bother yourself. You can do it right here, right now. Or the crucifixion scene, where Jesus is doing whatever he's doing. And on one side is one of the thieves who is literally in hell, who wants to get down, who's blaming and cursing and swearing. And the other one who's somehow or another transformed by this experience. Tradition calls him Saint Dismas, the good thief. And Jesus recognizing that and saying, today thou shalt be with me in paradise. You're already halfway there, buddy. You're already free. Your body just hasn't realized that yet. You're already free, and your freedom will be not rewarded so much as your freedom will come to be shown in reality of who and what you truly are. What hell is the decision that God cannot penetrate or realize itself in what already is, which would be an impossibility. And an interesting story about hell. There's a Franciscan priest who's got a whole meditation thing online. His name is Richard Rohr. He does some really good stuff. And I remember, there's a whole story behind this too, but I won't bore you with that. But I remember listening to one of his recordings, probably about, gosh, it was a long time ago. Doesn't matter how long it was. But anyway, he was talking about hell. Somebody asked him about hell. Question and answer thing. And he said, as a Catholic priest, I am required to believe in the doctrine of hell, that hell exists. But even though I might believe that hell exists, or I need to believe that hell exists, I don't have to believe that there's anybody there. I said, oh. Hell is a state of consciousness where I seem to lack the ability to be able to take in or digest or be touched by unconditional love. And I think all of us have in some ways probably experienced that on some level of our being when we thought that was true. And we felt that was true emotionally. But it wasn't so true, or I wasn't holding on to it as being so true, that I didn't believe it at all. The belief in the possibility that I can see beyond this pain, that I can see beyond this depression, that I can see beyond this struggle was still there, even though I didn't feel it, even though there was nothing in the outside world that could tell me that it was true. The reality of knowing that there was something beyond the suffering and pain was true to me. If it was not, I would have done myself in a long time ago. Now, in this dense field, dense being heavy, hard to get through, struggle, lower consciousness, lower vibration. Lower vibration, the more dense it is. Now, in the dense field you have operated in, you have chosen to know yourselves in confirmation of fear, of separation from your brothers and sisters, and from the source of your being. Unfortunately, a lot of us were taught that. You know, God's up there and you're down here. And we've taught to be identified with our ego consciousness and our personality consciousness, which by its very essence is separate from other people's. This is who you are. You are this personality, you are this ego. And by the way, if you haven't realized it yet, it's separate from everyone and everything else. Sort of, we've taken our uniqueness and even twisted that around. To know yourselves in confirmation of fear, of separation from your brothers and sisters, from the source of your being. So the idea that something can be reclaimed, realized, and renown, and lifted to what we call the upper room, would be an impossibility at that level of agreement. So again, that's another way of saying it, that you don't get to the higher consciousness through the lower consciousness. Your lower self or your lower vibration seems to want to think that way, but it doesn't work that way. Like the image of what I do, I think it was last week, the image of the Tower of Babel. All these people getting together, they were building a stairway to heaven, literally, right? That's what they wanted to do. And I never realized this before until I thought about it, but it's such a powerful model for using the lower vibrational self to try and reach the higher vibrational self. And it doesn't work. It finally collapsed. And what they did was they created more separateness than they began with, because they were all speaking different languages metaphorically, right? Couldn't understand one another after the whole thing fell apart. But as you have come, each and every one of you who responds to these words, who goes into the echo of his or her own resonance as the true self, as you have come, you have been endowed and gifted with the responsibility to reclaim what you see in the high octave of the upper room. As we said earlier, I could see peace instead of this. I could see this differently. I choose differently. Not just my thoughts, but my state of mind and everything that might be connected with that. The upper room is the abiding presence of the divine beyond fear. And when you lift a thing to it through your sight and through your intention, you're lifting the thing that has known itself in separation to union with the source of all things. You can only do this as the one who knows who he is and who abides there in his vibratory echo, in her embodiment and agreement to serve. We have taught you the teaching. I know how I serve already. We will too as it is needed. We will return to it as needed. In this moment, we say to those of you who are present and who will hear these words and know the echo of them in the manifestation of your lives, in the realization of the divine in form, those of you who said yes will come anew, and in the claim we offer, I have come. I am here. The claim I have come is the announcement of being, the announcement of reclamation of the presence of the act of the Creator that can be expressed through the individual soul, through the Christ itself, the unique lens that you are, that has assumed the soul and claimed manifest in form as who and what you are. So we don't deny form, we claim ourselves through form. Our physical bodies, our personality, our ego consciousness, right? All of that's part of the picture. We don't throw any of that away. And as we teach this, I have come, the vibratory echo or response of the manifest world will be the reclamation of the kingdom, which is the awareness of the presence of the divine that can be known while in form. The world you see before you is asking for reclamation. And reclamation, in this case, is the realization of the divine that can be seen and comprehended and known anew through your presence and through the decree, I have come. How am I a reflection or a projection of divine consciousness today? And can I do that right where I'm sitting at the moment? My mind might want to go, oh, well, you have to do this and you have to do that and you have to do this and you have to do that. And maybe you do. I'm not a judge of that. You are. Maybe that's part of your requirement. I don't know. But I know for me, the question might be, how can I make the actions that are before me that I'm planning on doing not only open my heart, but how can I make them into acts of love? Cleaning the cat ears off the sofa, act of love. Vacuuming the carpet, act of love. Cleaning up some cat puke in the kitchen, act of love. Coming to class this evening, act of love. Cooking dinner afterwards, act of love. Remember that wonderful quote from Thich Nhat Hanh? He was talking about living in the present moment, making everything an act of love. And he said so beautifully, he said, the next time you do the dishes, imagine that each dish is a little baby Buddha. So instead of, you know, scrubbing the dishes and throwing it in the dryer, you know, it's a little baby Buddha. And I'm so gentle and loving as I'm kind of wiping it clean and I very gently put it in the rack when I'm finished. So get ready, lovingly getting ready to pick up another one. And I go, ah, can't wait for these dishes to be over with. It's a little baby Buddha. Imagine that each dish is a little baby Buddha. I love that. I'm going to ask you to put your books down. We got a little bit of time for a longer meditation tonight, so we'll do that.
Gary, can I say something real quick before you start?
I just want to say how I just have learned tonight a lot about the way I do things and the way God sees things. And my way was always to fix it and go and try and get a pill for somebody or you know, run and find it, you know, like that. And this was telling me tonight, the I have come part is when you have come, when you can offer love and you can offer yourself in love to someone else, not let me run, get you a pill or a Band-Aid.
Right.
That's what I learned tonight.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
So you can just kind of settle into the physical space where you're in. Take a couple of deep breaths as you close your eyes. And notice the area around your belly and your abdomen. And allow it to soften. Breathe into it. Let go of that residual tension that's usually there. Soften. Be open to receiving. And know that you are giving as well, because you can't do one without the other. Even though our focus this evening, or for this meditation, might be receiving, know that you are receiving for all beings. It's not just you. We're not just the separate you. So allow yourself to just sort of gently fall into the rhythm of your breathing. And with each breath you take, allow yourself to open even a little bit more and a little bit more. As you receive, both in form and in energy, whatever it is you need to receive this evening, you are aligned to the source, which means that everything you need, even everything you want or desire, is present. Play with the words that Jesus spoke, because he also said, I have come. I have come that you might have life and have it more abundantly. I have come that you might have life and have it more abundantly. And let that fill you. Let that resonate with your truth. Let it flow through you. Let it touch every cell and fiber of your being, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. I have come that you might have life and have it more abundantly. And with your eyes closed and your breathing steady, I'm going to just read to you the last paragraph of tonight's work, because I think it sums things up neatly. Now, this is not a new teaching, Paul, but it is the complete application of all the teachings thus far. They have all brought you to this moment of announcement. They are not to be confused one with the other. This is the outcome of all the prior attunements we have gifted you with. The attunement to the word in preparation for the claim of identity. I know who I am, what I am, how I serve. The claim of being. I am here. And the claim of freedom. I am free. That reclamates you, announces you in totality in the claim, I have come. And this announcement of being as the divine self is what trumpets and heralds the awakening of humanity. I claim the truth of being here. I do not have to know what that means with my thinking mind.
Yeah.
I can know the truth of it here and now, with me and with all beings. And so I leave you this evening with that Buddhist blessing. May all beings be at peace. May all beings be free of suffering. And may all beings remember who they are. Deep breath and stretch a bit. You can open your eyes when you're ready.
Thank you, Jerry. That was very nice. More than nice. I was trying to find what is the word? What is the word? Enlightening.
Enlightening. Mm-hmm. Thank you all. Hope you have a great rest of the week.
Thank you. Oh,
yeah,
Jerry.
By the way, at the end, we're gonna have classes up until the end of June. And then we're going to be taking July and August off on Tuesday evening. Right. Sunday will still be there, but Tuesday night we'll be starting again at Labor Day. Okay.
This is almost a crisis.
Okay. Trying to remind you that again. So take care, guys. Have a good week.
Thank you, Jerry.
Okay.